Again, here on New England Lifestyles, here as part of the Odyssey radio stations that you listen to every week. Appreciate that. So every week we talk to folks making a difference. We talk to people with perspectives, and we talk about the big stories of the day. And one of the biggest stories so far this year has been the trial of Officer Chauvin and the death of George Floyd. And that played out in front of America this week. And joining me on the phone to discuss this is my go-to trial guy and lawyer. His name is Richard Bell. He's a New York City civil rights and liability trial attorney. He's also the author of a book called Voting, The Ultimate Act of Resistance. Richard, welcome back to the program.
Oh, Mike, thanks for having me back. I couldn't wait to talk to you about all these issues that came up because it's been a very important week in America, and I just love talking to you about it.
It really has. Now, obviously, the difference in this trial, because let's go back to the first time most of us had our first interaction with videotape and police officers charged. Now, first off, we're going to start by saying we know the vast majority of police officers are doing a great job, and they're doing their best to protect the people. That has never been in question. The question we have is when rogue officers do go off and do things which are questionable and not in the public's interest. We go back to Rodney King and that beating he took and how those officers were acquitted. Everyone, that was really the first opportunity people saw of, holy cow, I saw with my own eyes. How did this happen? And now here we are and we got a conviction. What were your initial thoughts on him being found guilty?
Okay, well, first of all, I thought if it wasn't going to come in not guilty, then it was going to really be a crushing blow to the criminal justice system and a crushing blow to our commitment to racial equality since this happened. So I was very pleased that they convicted him on all three counts. That's number one.
Yeah.
So I was very relieved in looking at it over a little period of time now. It's a great first step. But we have a steep staircase of thousands of steps to go to make the kind of reforms we need to make in the country in this area.
It's an interesting thing because as this verdict was happening, there was another police shooting, which was very different. And it's caused a firestorm and it's caused a lot of regret with people like LeBron James, who immediately tweeted out, not all situations with police and those who are engaged are the same. This shooting that took place in Columbus was very different than what happened with George Floyd.
Right. So one thing that we can learn from the trial for those who listened to the summation of the prosecutors, which I thought was excellent, was when they made the point, the police department and the police are not on trial. Derek Chauvin is on trial because that's what trials are about.
Absolutely.
They are about cases and controversies. They are about the individual facts. Now, when we want to get to police reforms, then we're talking about legislation and policy. But in a courtroom, it's about the event before you. So you made this very clear in your introduction here, and I think we all need to keep that in mind, that in every lawsuit, whether it's criminal or civil, it's the facts and circumstances of that particular case that's on trial.
I know that one of the most overwhelming pieces of evidence, and this is really, one of the things that you see is that the police report that was initially filed said there was a defendant who seemed to be under the influence of drugs. During the arrest, he suffered some medical emergency, and he died en route to the hospital. That was the initial report. This young woman, who was one of the key witnesses in this trial, said, no, I was there, I stood. And she stood there for that full 10 minutes and recorded that video, which ultimately is the piece of evidence that I think convicted Derek Chauvin. The ability of folks to be first person there, so much of eyewitness testimony is questionable because no matter what anyone says, eyewitness testimony is not always dependable. And we've seen that again and again. But when you are able to view the events with the way the advent of cell phones has happened, I mean, that really has changed the way things are adjudicated now, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I would say that young woman and those other witnesses that were there, they are true heroes in our country because you heard them one after the next, not just recounting the painful experience, but some of them actually feeling a sense of guilt that they weren't able to do more, and they weren't able to do more. You can't jump in the middle of a police action other than verbally as they did and taking the video as they did. But it is it is so important that we don't forget that because of them, we were able to have a case where the jury really got to see the evidence up close and personal.
And those, and watching those 9 minutes, I mean, you made a great point. And we can talk about the way this trial was tried. You know, we saw so many witnesses. And this was one of the first times in a long time that people have actually been able to view a trial. Trial is kind of like behind the velvet curtain for most people. You hear about trials, you see the results of trials, and you're not always watching them. But so many people had their eyes on this trial. And as a member of the law community, it must have been fascinating that America was now in on the proceedings. And one of the things that really stuck out to me was the way that the prosecution presented their case. And as you said, you know, making a clear definition of the police are not on trial, Derek Chauvin is on trial. But then again, the defense's contention consistently that there was something beyond the kneeling on the neck that killed him, and kind of a lack of a real defense, and the way Chauvin did not stand up and, you know, go on the trial himself. Now, obviously, that's a risk. Talk about why a defendant in this situation would not get up there on trial to try to defend himself.
Well, I would say two reasons for Chauvin. Number one, Chauvin had, I think it was something like 16 complaints in other cases, not necessarily cases, meaning court cases, but in investigations regarding misconduct. And we don't know the adjudication of them. But once you take the stand, you subject yourself to being questioned about them. And what defense lawyer wants his client to now be questioned to looking like a serial abuser of his authority? So I think that would be number one. Number two, did you get a look at Mr. Chauvin? Is that a man that you want to put up before a jury? Because I'll tell you, the visual is not good. He does not make a particularly good impression in court.
You know, it's interesting. One of the alternate jurors, did you see the interview she did?
I did.
I found that fascinating. She said that, you know, as she sat in there, every time she locked eyes with Chauvin, she got a chill through her body. That's a tough thing to overcome. And look, you cannot help your looks. But it's an intriguing thing that a defendant's actions, just as he observes, can really play a part in a trial, can't it?
Oh, let me tell you something. I try lots and lots of cases. And every time I try a case, I tell, number one, my client, that jury is looking at you when you go in and out of the courtroom, when you're sitting there, when you stand up, when you stretch, whatever you do, because they are judging your credibility. And part of the jury instruction on credibility is temperament, the way the person acts in the courtroom, the way they appear to you. That's all fair game, because it is a human judgment that you're making about somebody's truthfulness and the truthfulness of the facts in the case. So it is extremely important. And I find through my own trials that, you know what, you don't have to look a certain way, but you have to be an honest person and a sincere person. And it will eventually come across, and you do it your way, however you are comfortable in your own skin doing it. And that's why I said, when I looked at Chauvin, boy, there was just a look there about the guy that I would say was probably one of the reasons he wasn't taking the stand.
And you have to ask yourself many things, because Chauvin was married to a woman who is, you know, she was from Southeast Asia. She has said that he's really a sensitive, warm guy. And obviously that might be something that a wife would say, but you hear certain things about him. But ultimately, what happened that day, it really showed something that was chilling to America. When someone is in distress, begging for their lives, screaming for their mother, I mean, it was just such a chilling video to watch. I mean, it almost gets you to ask the question, do all people have a dark side to them? You know, you hear everyone, whenever there's something like this, oh, I knew him, he was a quiet man.
Right. The neighbor says the serial killer, he seemed like a terrific fellow. I saw him, you know, say hello to every day. But yes, I think, obviously, it wasn't just the video and watching him literally have the life sucked out of poor Mr. Floyd. But it was the look on his face. It was his ignoring the crowd. It was his arrogance toward the crowd. It was things that just aren't human reactions.
Yeah, it was mind-blowing. And again, if you're just joining us here on New England Lifestyles, I'm Mike Mullaney. It's great to have you listening. I am joined by my frequent guest, New York civil rights attorney and liability trial attorney. He talks a lot about voting law in his new book, Voting, The Ultimate Act of Resistance. And again, if you have information you'd like to get about law, his website is 877-CALL-LAW.com. You know, as we look at this trial and we look at the way it played out, there's always a lot of questions about juries. How, you know, because when you say that, you know, it's not like a civil case where you just need a majority. In a criminal case, you need a unanimous decision. And getting 12 people to agree to anything is a challenge. So much is at stake when, you know, you go without down that path. How hard is it to get a conviction in a major case? I mean, how often do you have those, that one guy who just sticks to his guns? I mean, it's a fascinating concept.
Yes. Okay. Well, actually, in civil cases, and it depends on the states, we have unanimous verdicts also, but we can consent to 5-6 verdicts because we have 6 jurors instead of 12 now, at least in New York. So many times it is required to be unanimous. But either way, here's the deal. When you try a case, you are presenting to that jury what you believe the evidence says, because you can be the greatest lawyer in the world. The evidence is the evidence. Now, there's a way to present it, and there's a way to present your witnesses, and there's a way to sum up and give opening arguments. But the facts of the case are limiting to you. In the defense attorney had what I felt was a horrible case. Forget about what he did or didn't do. The facts of this case, those 9 minutes, how you get around that video, the answer is you don't. So you have to, and of course, in a criminal case, because it's the higher standard beyond a reasonable doubt, you have to basically make sure that the few people that may be looking for reasonable doubt and may be hard to convince are kept into a mode of how overwhelming the evidence is, that there's just no escaping it, even if you want to escape it.
Yeah, that's a good point. One of the things that is fascinating is you see a lot of stuff online. Online is a dangerous place to be because people post things. We've talked about this. I saw something on TikTok which fascinated me yesterday, and it was someone from the military talking about the way, police shootings. And he says, look, when U.S. military is in a hostile enemy territory, we still have to go by the following escalation. Shout, shove, show, which is showing your weapon. Shoot, mm-hmm. and then shoot to kill. So it's a 5-step process. When you are U.S. military in enemy territory, you still have to shout, shove, show, shoot to kill. And I heard that, and I was like, that's fascinating that they, even in enemy territory, as members of the U.S. military, have to follow these levels of procedure. Are police departments held to that standard?
Well, here's the thing. The answer is, held to that standard, that is the standard for the most part, that there are very serious procedures they have to follow. One of the things that the public doesn't always understand is that when we talk about excessive force, like the jury found in this case, that's force that exceeds the level that's reasonably necessary to accomplish the purpose. The purpose is to make the arrest or to detain. That was all done here. We all saw that. It was over. The man was of no threat to them at the point where he started to put him on the ground and put his knee on him.
And it's a very different situation in Columbus, where the police arrived in the scene and there was a woman about to stab somebody.
Right. So in Columbus, I think one of the things we have to always do, and you began the show with this, is you can't have a rush to judgment. We have to get all the facts. We have a few facts right now and some videos. Things will come out later. Maybe it's because I'm a lawyer, but I always like to see as much as I can see before I like to give an opinion on it, because we just don't know what is out there. It's still pending investigation, of course.
And we want to stress this. Police department has an exceptionally difficult job, and police officers die every day. It's a harrowing situation, and you have to know going in that any call could be your last. So we're in, again, we want to stress we're in no way, presenting a case against police under no circumstances. We're talking about specific cases.
No, we all want our police to protect us and care for us and have a good relationship with our communities. And we understand the very difficult position that they are put in every day. And we put them in a more difficult position when we don't have the kinds of standards and the kinds of training and the kinds of community relations that are part of the institution. That's where all these reforms are being talked about, because it's about the institution. You want to put the police in as best a position as possible to do their job. And part of their job in many circumstances is to de-escalate things as opposed to have confrontations get out of hand. And that's for the safety of the person and for the safety of the officer. Of course, we respect that police have an extremely difficult job.
And we even saw it in the Derek Chauvin trial that the police want trustworthy and good policemen as well. And that's why some of the people in the prosecution's case were members of the police department.
Well, I think that is something, that's a really good point. You just don't see that.
Yeah.
We're not just fellow officers, but supervisors. They all came in and said, this is completely wrong. This is not what we're taught. This is not what we do. This was completely over the line. And, you know, that goes a long way. I have police officers and retired police officers that have been clients of mine or I deal with in the professional level. Every one of them who I spoke to about this case before the trial ended said, oh, I hope he gets convicted. That was horrible. That is absolutely wrong, totally over the line, and it's completely disrespectful to our profession.
Well, look at it this way. We, again, America, we don't love the reason we're watching a trial, but there's nothing as compelling as a really tense criminal trial and watching what happens. We've been, you know, some of the great memories of our lives are about watching trials and seeing what happens. And we got one where this, you know, again, there was a conviction which most people were looking for. And it was a fascinating peek behind the scenes of the criminal justice system. Well, again, as always, it is a pleasure to speak to you, sir. Richard Bell, New York City civil rights and liability trial attorney, and also author of the book Voting, The Ultimate Act of Resistance. And we talked a lot about voting the last time. I'm sure the next time around we'll be having more of the same. But I really appreciate you making time, because this was a fascinating trial. Wanted to get your perspective.
Mike, it's never enough time, and I'm always happy to come back and thank you for all the great questions.
Richard Bell, thanks for being here on New England Lifestyles.
Thank you.